the first show of Apropos of Something, airing every Saturday morning from 10 to 11, co-hosted by me, Ellen Daniels, in our Charlottesville studio, and Nancy Lawrence, coming to us from New York City. Nancy, are you there?
I am apropos of here. I am curious, how loud am I to you?
I don't think you should worry.
You are loud to me. I'm concerned.
Okay.
I'm already concerned. 4 seconds and I'm concerned.
Don't be concerned. I'm looking at my monitors here. Okay, so this is a little key into our personalities. And the reason we're doing this show is because these queasy times call for humor and information while they're still allowed. We're going to cover the hottest issues with a focus on the world and especially Charlottesville and local resistance efforts. Today's topic is immigration and refugees on the heels of the executive order from last week banning immigration, limiting travel from 7 countries. We have 4 amazing guests with us today. We're going to hear personal stories, what Charlottesville is doing, and we're going to bring in an expert legal perspective. So, Nancy, hello, my co-host in New York City.
Well, hello to you, and I'm going to just assume we already have listeners, Ellen. I'm going to assume.
For sure.
There's a flock of them, if that's the correct gathering for a group of listeners. I am thrilled. Ellen, you totally, I must.
Well, let me interrupt.
You totally did this.
Yeah, I was going to say. I was going to say, can you believe we're on, now will you believe me?
I'm still thinking you're faking this. It's like a Truman Show. You're doing this all on my behalf to prove that we have a radio show. And once, you know, whenever this, if, once I walk into that door with the sky painted on it, I will realize that this has all been for me. Anyway.
Oh, my gosh.
Thank you. I want to publicly declare that thank you for doing this and for creating this little radio bubble for an hour a week. I will totally take it. I love it.
I'm making your life worth living, as you once said.
Yeah, I did once say that, didn't I?
Yeah. So I also want to talk about what's, well, you're welcome, first of all. But no, thank you very much. And what is going on activism-wise in Seville is a little bit what I want to plug right now.
Okay.
There are a bunch of organizations here I want people to know about. I think a lot of us feel overwhelmed, and I think it's important to plug into some of these organizations that are already doing so much work and can help. So one is Indivisible. Another is SURGE, S-U-R-J, which stands for Standing Up for Racial Justice, Together Charlottesville, One Virginia 2021, which is interested in voting and redistricting. And Indivisible has an action on Tuesday, February 7th at noon. They're having a pro-immigration action at Representative Tom Garrett's office. That's 686 Berkmar Circle in Charlottesville, 22901. You can find Indivisible Charlottesville on Facebook. So I'm ready to get started. How about you, Nancy?
I am. I didn't know that. I know that you've been busy, so I wanted to ask if you are, though, aware of these other executive orders from Trump. I know you've been busy this morning, and I wanted to let you know that there have been a few more. These are all, of course, jokes by me, so don't worry. It's not like the world is still here.
Yeah. No, but I hadn't heard about them, so please fill me in.
Yes, indeed. There will be, I'm pretty sure, to expect very soon, the national holiday to honor the man's signature. I think that is coming. I think he will. If I know you don't check his Twitter feed, but that one's coming, as is. There will be all citizens, the ones he, of course, considers citizens. We will all have to memorize his primary results, you know, the winning ones. And of course, probably be stopped and searched to, you know, surprise quizzed. I think that's coming. And lastly, that, you know, we will only get your travel in around the world because we will only be able to travel to places where there's a Trump hotel. I think that too will become an executive order.
Thank you. Very enlightening.
Yeah, he's been busy. You know, he gets up at 3. So. Okay, I am done.
Okay.
I know we have guests.
It's not that I'm not listening. It's that I am doing a trillion things over here on my end.
I know you are.
So let's talk to our first guest. Rachel's actually a friend of mine, Rachel Adams. She is a registered nurse and a doula. She earned a degree in nursing from the University of Virginia and a certificate in global health from UAB Birmingham. She has experience working with female survivors of trauma in the nonprofit setting and is passionate about incorporating trauma-informed care into birth. Most relevant, she's back just yesterday from Thessaloniki, Greece, where she was working alongside Syrian families in camps and hotels around the city. Welcome, Rachel.
Thank you. Hi, Ellen.
Hi,
Nancy.
Hi, Rachel.
I'm so glad to be here.
Thank you so much. Yes, exactly. Our first guest. You know,
I'm so excited and honored.
The inaugural chair and microphone. Okay. All right. Enough. I'm sorry. I will get to the questions. I know we're on schedule. So, Rachel, I want to start with the most basic one, but important one. What were you doing there?
So I went to Thessaloniki to work with a humanitarian aid organization, and this particular one provides care to pregnant women and mothers and babies who are living in camps and hotels around the city. So there are some pretty big gaps for the families who live there as far as prenatal care, and so the organization I went with did a lot of prenatal visits with women and a lot of breastfeeding support and a lot of emotional support as well for women with new babies.
Did your going there, or let me ask it this way, did your being a doula lead you to helping refugees, or did you always want to help refugees regardless? How do they fit together?
So I have been following the refugee crisis for a few years, and definitely it has always pulled at my heart. And I think, like many people in the United States, we feel pretty helpless and want to help, but don't know how to do that. And so back in the fall, even before the current political climate, I found out about this organization, and it seemed like the perfect connection of both the heart and the desire to go, but then actually a way to use skills that I have as a birth doula and as a pediatric nurse. So it seemed like the perfect storm, and I received a lot of encouragement from friends and families, and was very excited to go.
And how did you wind up in Greece? How did that happen?
So the organization I went with is currently only working in Greece.
And so
this is the place where they were working now, where they had permission to be in specific camps there and provide the services.
And I'm not sure that this is true, but obviously you're here to correct me. Are you only working with Syrians there, or who are the refugees you are helping, I guess, whichever way that makes
sure.
sense?
Sure. Yeah. So it was, I would say, probably 90 to 95% Syrian in the particular camps where we worked. There were a few Iraqi families as well. But the majority of the people we worked with were Syrians from Aleppo and Idlib, a few people from Damascus. And they were the people who had arrived in Greece earlier in 2016 and tried to make their way north in order to cross the Macedonian border. And then, I don't know if you saw this back in May, there was a big thing where the borders were closed and all of the people who were trying to cross into Macedonia were then transported down to Thessaloniki. So these were the families that I was working with.
And how did that affect that settlement, or if that's the incorrect word, I apologize, but how did them, you know, getting stuck more or less affect your, you know, what it looked like down there for you and your work, I guess, at that point?
Yeah, so one thing I have learned about the refugee experience is that it requires a maddening amount of patience and waiting.
Yeah. Yeah.
One of my fellow volunteers called the camps the waiting room of the world. And so I just witnessed people who were living their lives sort of in limbo, had been hopeful for a new life, but had waited for months in Turkey and then waited for months at the Macedonian border, and now we're stuck yet again in Thessaloniki waiting once more for interviews for asylum. And so I think I saw a great sense of community, and I saw some hope, but also a fair amount of discouragement and just the effects of having to spend their months waiting and waiting.
I just want to interject a moment just to let people who may have just tuned in that you're listening to Resistance Radio on 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville, and we're talking about immigration and refugees with our guest Rachel Adams and co-host Nancy Lawrence. I'm Ellen Daniels here in Charlottesville. Nancy's beaming in from New York City. And we'll be talking to other guests also. Back to you, Nancy.
Oh, okay. Rachel, I knew that pass off was coming. I'm sorry. I was wondering, in all of your meeting with them, does your being an American, I don't know, is that how do you play that, or does that come into effect that you are from here?
Yes.
Do they trust you? Anyway, you answer it your way. I'm sorry.
Yeah, it was a very interesting time to be working there. And daily, I would have conversations with people about the political climate and everything that was happening. Mm-hmm. So people would often ask me where I was from, and I said, I'm American. And always the response, I would say, was kind and hospitable. Usually came with a cup of tea and a smile. However, I did have several experiences where when saying I'm an American, just seeing the faces of people change, it was really difficult. There was one man I had a conversation with who, when he learned I was an American, and I started to apologize and say, I'm sorry for everything that has happened. And he said, well, we will be hopeful. We will see what happens. And then, of course, I went home and later that day found out that Trump had issued the executive order banning immigration. So that was definitely a hard moment for me.
Well, yeah, Ellen actually probably said this at the beginning. I did not realize you actually were traveling on that day. That's mm-hmm. what you're, I know you got home safely, but, or you got, anyway, close enough to that day. And what is your feeling about returning to do this work you've been doing?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, what a time to return to. Part of my hope in going was to be able to offer some concrete skills and help, but far more so my motivation was to go and to bear witness to what is happening and to be able to come home and share stories. And so I really see that as my job right now, to come home and to talk and to share about what I've seen and what I've heard and what I've witnessed. And just pray that that, in some way, sheds some light and hope on the subject.
Well, to that point, can you, with, in addition to the gentleman you just described, what, something that was surprising in any way to you about a story from a refugee or...
Or just a great story or something that pulled on mm-hmm. your heartstrings.
Yeah. Gosh, it is so hard to think of just one.
Okay, don't. Then whatever's coming to mind. I'd just be curious, like, any detail
sure.
about it.
I met so many incredible people and so many interesting people. I met a man who was a librarian in Aleppo, and I met another gentleman who was a chemical engineer. I met a man whose wife was a music teacher and a woman who... had just been studying economics at university before she ended up having to flee Aleppo with her husband. And so I think, we know this theoretically, but I was reminded again that the people of Syria are many individuals, people with diverse backgrounds and stories. They're families, they are funny, they're not just the label of refugee. And that was really, it was so good to be reminded of that. And then the other thing that really stands out to me is the hospitality that I experienced. I had people, families a number of times want to cook for me and offer me
in
tea.
The camp,
and,
in the camp. In the settlement or whatever you call
yeah,
it.
Yeah, in the camp or in the... There were a few people who were in apartments around the city who had kitchens and were able to cook a little bit better. But even in a camp, you know, spreading out a blanket on a concrete floor and sharing a meal with a family was moving and profound, and I was really humbled to receive that hospitality.
I can't imagine. I actually can't even imagine how, and it's, I'm sure not all of them, but that they, you know, that they pursue, you know, they persevere there, and, you know, they keep on despite, you know, being beaten.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I mean, I don't even like to talk about it because you actually saw it firsthand, but that is incredible that, you know, they're not giving, some of them, anyway, are not giving up.
Yeah,
I think
absolutely.
I remember maybe, Rachel, a post you had that said that their hearts get broken again and again, over and over
yeah.
and over,
mm-hmm.
just that resilience. I just want to remind people we're listening to 94.7 WPVC Resistance Radio, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. This is the first show of Apropos of Something with hosts myself, Ellen Daniels, and Nancy Lawrence coming from New York City. We may want to talk to our next guest coming up, but before we do, I just want to thank Rachel and ask if maybe Elizabeth could go get our next guest in the next room.
Yeah.
Okay. Nancy, back to you.
Sure. You're obviously being given the boot, Rachel. But
thank you for having me.
Thank you, as Ellen already did, and also say that, because I know you mentioned that, you know, you're spending time here talking and sharing about your time in Greece, that we will book you again. I'm already decided, because I want to know how it is, how you are being. I'm very curious how you will be received here and what other eye-opening things you encounter on this side of the Atlantic.
Well, thank you. Yes, it would be an honor to come back, and it's been an honor to be here.
Well, thank you. I'm sure you've this will definitely get put on your resume somewhere as the first guest. So as it should be. In fact, I'm sure you're going to open up your phone and get that up to date. Really, thank you so much. I'm really glad you truly arrived.
Safely
arrived without incident. You're very lucky, obviously. Like, I need to tell you, but you were very lucky for that.
Yeah.
So our okay. Thank you. So our next guest, I think we'll talk to Elizabeth.
Hi.
Hi there. Let me introduce Elizabeth.
Okay.
This is Elizabeth Valtierra. No, that's not right. say it.
Elizabeth Valtierra.
Valtierra. She is an awesome teen activist who's Mexican-American and a student at Charlottesville High School. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Elizabeth, you sound so grown up. This is Nancy. Sorry. You sound already like you're out of high school, but you, for the record, you are in high school, no?
Yes, I'm a senior.
All right.
So we're going to come back. We need to go to a hard break now. We'll come back with Elizabeth. This is Apropos of Something on 94.7 WPVC Resistance Radio, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. Welcome to Apropos of Something. We're here at 94.7 WPVC Resistance Radio, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. We're talking with four guests on immigration and refugees here in the studio. This is our first show of Apropos of Something with my co-host Nancy Lawrence in New York City. I'm Ellen Daniels here in the studio in Charlottesville. We'll be talking to you about world events, things that are going on in Charlottesville, and recent actions that you can take, or recent things that are being planned by organizations that are local throughout our programming. So our next guest we introduced before the break, she is Elizabeth Valtierra, an awesome teen activist, Mexican-American student at Charlottesville High School.
Hi.
Welcome back.
Thank you. Welcome back
for our commercial break. I wanted to ask a very basic, but I am genuinely curious, what inspired you to get involved? And when did you realize you wanted to get involved? However, that makes sense for you to answer.
I think it started around junior year when I started becoming more aware of my identity and how I identify myself. In my family, I am the first generation student-wise, and which means that I'm going to be the first to go into college. And so it makes me look at things more differently and have different struggles than most of my other peers. And so around that time, I realized that many of my cousins and my brother don't have the same opportunity as I do. And I was like, this is unfair. You know, education shouldn't be a privilege. It should be a right. So I was like, how can I get involved and help them out? And so that's around the time where I was like, yeah, I need to start taking action and demanding more opportunities for people that are less privileged as I am in my community, especially Latinos communities.
And how did you, maybe you are still involved in the exact same ways, but when you first decided that, how did you first get involved? What did you decide to do?
When I first started getting involved, I kind of educated myself a lot first. And then,
gotcha.
Yeah, so I started learning more and started talking to teachers. And I was like, how mm-hmm. can I help out many of my Latino peers at my school? And then after that, I went volunteering at this local organization in Charlottesville called Sin Barreras, which is there to help out Latino families that speak Spanish only or undocumented families with legal aid, financials, you know, problems. And I just started volunteering, and they kind of giving me more and more opportunities, and I just started taking advantage of it.
Did you say you started? I wasn't sure. Did you say you started your own organization?
No. I started volunteering with an organization.
Oh, okay. All right. Because if I need to be standing up at attention while I talk to you, I mean, geez, you're already doing way more than I did in high school.
Thank you.
But enough about me. I was just wondering what issues are important to you know are important to you, and what you know did things happen in your life to do that to make these issues important.
Issues that are important to me that caused me to get involved?
Yes.
Okay. Definitely.
You mentioned your family. I'm sorry.
Sorry. Definitely immigration. It was the first thing that was there. And then it's education. It's like most important for me because I was just, you know, astounded that, you know, many undocumented students cannot get in-state tuition because of their residency. And I've felt like that is so unfair. So it's like started learning more and more how to take action and calling your senators and calling your representatives and, you know, working on organizations that's creating bills to allow these students to have in-state tuitions or medical expenses. Yeah. And so, it's, you know, involved with lobbying as well.
Which, actually, I am wondering this. Given your age, how is it for you getting lawmakers to listen to you, to meet with you? You know, how is that going? I'm sure it varies, but how does that work for you?
Well, I can't take all the credit, but I work with I have a class at my school called Becoming Global Citizen, which purpose is to raise awareness around global issues or cultural issues or political issues on a local, state, or national level, even to the point international. And so being in that class, they helped me learn more how to hone my politics skills, like how to hone my public speaking skills and how to contact my representatives and how to, get their attention and learn their ways, because many politicians are always trying to change the topic the minute you bring up something that they're not very fond of. So,
do you have an actual experience? Sorry about that. Do you have an actual experience of going to lobby?
Yes. I've went lobbying twice already. One in Washington, D.C., working alongside Amnesty International, lobbying for refugee rights. And that was incredible. It was my first lobbying experience. And then the second one was recently on January 18th, 2 days before the inauguration, which was with Sin Barreras en Bacolao, which is Virginia organization for Latinos or communities. And yeah, we went lobbying for DACA and Dreamer students.
Are you always on the move? Like, cause I know you mentioned organizations in Charlottesville and some, I guess, in the capital and wherever. So are you always traveling for things? It sounds like you're always on the move.
Well, it really depends on if my mom allows me, but...
Well, exactly. I know you're supposed to be a student, so, but yeah, exactly. How do you manage all that?
You know, sometimes I go off a little, like I lose my track and I just start to focus on politics, and which is involves a lot on missing school and getting involved and, you know, slacking a little. But thankfully, my parents are always there to remind me. It's like, if you can't go far, if you don't have a good education, you know. And I was like, you're right.
That's right. That's why I'm doing this. That's right. And how are your, I mean, why wouldn't they be? But how are your parents about? What is their reaction to your drive and your commitment to these causes?
My parents have been the most supportive people in my life. They've helped me how to debate, and they helped me how to, you know, perfect in my arguments. And they've mainly, like, really just tell me this. They're very proud of me, and they will always be behind me, and they're very, very, like, progressive themselves.
In the just remaining time that we have with Elizabeth, I just wanted to ask you what you would recommend other students your age who may not be just really as interested right now, but they want to do something, or how would you inspire them? Or if they wanted to do something, they just don't know what to do, what would you recommend?
One thing I learned as being a young student and surrounding myself with a lot of young students as well, is that we all want to make a difference. We all want to have some sort of impact on this world. And we can, you know, it's easy. Just start getting connected at your school. It doesn't always have to be a big deal. And like in your state, it can always be in your family, in your school community, in your friends. And then you start realizing that you can not everyone has a leadership quality like that. Sometimes you have to learn how to get them leadership qualities. And so it's always baby steps, you know, and it's just take advantage of whatever situation you have.
I think, you know, just being an adult, that's also been important for everybody. So it's so inspiring to hear from you at a tender age, just to do something. Not, you know, people can't do everything, but everyone needs to do something. And just to pick what the thing, it's just so overwhelming, but just pick the thing that speaks to you. Pick the one cause, pick the one organization, and just do it.
Mm-hmm.
So thank you for that reminder. This is 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville and Resistance Radio. You're listening to the first show of Apropos of Something with Ellen Daniels, that's myself, and Nancy Lawrence in New York City. We'll be coming to you every Saturday at 10. So coming up will be our next guest. She is the director of the IRC in Charlottesville and Richmond. Her name is Harriet Coor. So she does not have headphones on. So let's just talk to Elizabeth just for a little bit more, and then we'll go right to Harriet.
Elizabeth.
Yes.
Are your teachers, are any of them making your life, you know, difficult? Because I have no idea. Are they as supportive? Let me ask it that way. Are they as supportive of what you're doing, or you know, how is that for you too?
My teachers are supportive, but, you know, they're more concerned about my academic grades my outside life. But I tell my government teachers and my AVID teachers, and, you know, they're helpful, and they connect me more and more with great people. And I've actually bonded with many teachers that are in my life, and it's really great experiences.
That's great. Are you, not that you, I'm not sure what is the month we're in. Anyway, are you already?
February.
Sorry.
I was going to say,
waiting for that sound cue?
Of all people, you should know about this month.
Anyway. This month?
Yeah, it's your birthday month. I'm going to say it on the air.
Oh, okay.
This could be a good,
I can't imagine Elizabeth.
I'm going to totally preempt you.
Okay, sorry.
That's okay. I just want to make sure we have time for everyone because we have really amazing people here. Elizabeth, thank you so, so much.
Thank you for having me. Thank you very much.
We also would love to have you back, maybe even behind, you know, where I'm sitting at the microphone.
Yes, you are.
I would be glad to come back.
Awesome. I know you have to go. I just thought that you are awesome at your age.
Thank you.
Okay, cool.
Keep doing it. Okay, so our next guest, as I mentioned earlier, is Harriet Kaur. She's the executive director of the International Rescue Committee, known as the IRC, in Charlottesville and Richmond. She's been with the IRC for 12 years and has spent 20 years working in the field of international cultural exchange. Welcome, Harriet.
Welcome. Oh, thank you.
You're very welcome.
Ah, you want me?
Yeah, I'd love for you, Nancy, to kind of take it.
Okay. Hi, Harriet.
Hi.
My first question to you is actually the word refugee. In your mind, or in what you work in, what does that actually cover? Because we use it all the time. So what does that mean?
That's a really good question. A lot of times when I talk with groups, I begin by actually defining the word refugee as we use it in our work. Because, as you said, it has a wide cultural context that we just use the word to mean anyone who's displaced. When we're talking about refugee resettlement in the United States, we're talking about people who legally enter this country through a program sponsored by the State Department, with a special humanitarian status as a refugee. In order to get that status, they have to have proven a claim that is based on persecution. So when we work with refugees coming, for example, to Charlottesville, even though people may have very valid reasons for migrating, for economic reasons, for better opportunities, the refugees we're working with, they have had to flee, and then their persecution claim is based on this very specific threats, such as that they're fleeing persecution based on political beliefs, ethnic beliefs, religious beliefs, different areas like that, and that they have a well-founded fear that they are already displaced from their home country. That's the other important thing. They've had to cross an international border and be located outside their home country, and that they have a well-founded fear of returning to their country based on this list of categories.
Now, the latest, Trump's Muslim ban, travel ban, I'm sure it already has. So how has that affected the work you've done in the last week? How has it affected your efforts?
Yeah, very significantly. There's kind of three parts of it. So there's part of that was a complete, there's like a moratorium on refugee entrance from any country, not just.
Oh.
So right now, beginning basically Thursday, there are no refugee arrivals from any country for 120 days, pending, quote, a review of the program. So
was that part of that secret thing that came up that he signed that no one knew about until like yesterday, or was that
that was part of the executive order from a week ago Friday? Yeah, so it was 120. So that means it affects, there's no Congolese coming, there's no Burmese coming. No one's coming from Bhutan. Even people from, quote unquote, low risk countries. No one is coming. So for 4 months, no refugee arrivals.
Wow, I did not know the any country clause. Anyway, that's why I interrupted you, but I didn't mean to. So sorry.
Well,
go ahead.
And then another element in there is the number of refugees that we're expecting to receive during this fiscal year. So from now until September 30th, was cut less than half than what we were prepared to receive. So the refugee arrival program is it actually is a presidential determination. So every year the president signs an authorization for refugees to enter the U.S. So President Obama at the beginning of the prior to the beginning of the fiscal year in October had signed a determination that 110,000 refugees could enter the U.S. The past year, we successfully resettled 85,000 refugees across the U.S. So we were prepared for that number, and all the agencies had really, you know, everywhere across the U.S. had really put together a plan to work with that number. It's now been reduced to 50,000. And before this moratorium went into effect this week, this past week, the U.S. had already resettled 30,000 refugees in the first 4 months of the year. So now no one for 4 months, and then a little bit less than 20,000 when we start up again, at some, hopefully sometime in the summer.
What does that stay on the travel ban from last night? It doesn't sound like it affects you because of what you just said. So, but does it?
So you're talking about the court order in Seattle?
Yes, that one.
Yeah. It's not clear to me. It's not clear to me, but okay. I think that that has a greater impact on visa holders and people coming with other kinds of travel documents.
So what exactly was that? Just briefly, what was that stay?
Well, I hardly want to be briefly. The expert on anything coming out of whatever Trump scribbles his name on, but I do believe it simply was that the travel ban had put a stay on it, and you could, if you had a visa, which apparently they've been making everyone toss them, but you could now travel those countries.
Right. I think this was, so there was the refugee thing specifically, and then there was this other thing, that the 90-day suspension of entrance from the 7 listed countries with any immigration status at all.
So, sorry to cut you a little bit short. We're just going to go to a break, but I just wanted to say that coming up, after a little bit of more time, we'll keep speaking with Harriet from the IRC. We're going to talk to Richard Schrager, who is a professor of law at the UVA School of Law, and his scholarship looks at the intersection of constitutional and local government law and lots of other things. And he's written a really interesting looking book called City Power, talking about the power of cities. Which is pertinent for us here in Charlottesville. Again, you're listening to 94.7 WPVC, Resistance Radio, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. We're going to go to a break, and when we come back, we'll talk some more. You're listening to 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. This is the first show of Apropos of Something with your co-host, me, Ellen Daniels, and Nancy Lawrence in New York City. I'm here in Charlottesville. Right now we're talking about immigration and refugees, the situation with last week's executive order, and we are just in the middle of talking to Harriet Kaur, who is the IRC director, and then after that, we're going to talk with Richard Schrager, who is a UVA law professor. We're going to talk about some constitutional issues. So, Harriet, Nancy, I don't know if you had a burning question, but I just wanted to know if there was something that you think people should know or something that you really want to touch on that we haven't talked about yet.
No, I just wanted, we talked about the suspension of the refugee admissions program, and then about the travel ban on people coming from the 7 listed countries. But I also want to add to that that the third provision that affected our work was an indefinite ban on arrivals from Syria. So that, you know, it's not just the 120 days on arrivals from Syria, and that most of the people entering the U.S. from Syria are entering as refugees. And so I believe that the current injunction only affects people who are actually visa holders.
Hey, Ellen, do I have time for one more question or no?
Let's do one more question.
Okay. Thank you. I was just wondering, Harriet, because of what Trump is doing involving the Muslim ban, are you worried? Obviously, I sound not like I am, but are you worried that all these organizations you work with will distrust whatever you're trying to, or not necessarily your efforts, but just working with the U.S. based on his attitudes?
You talk about organizations in the U.S., like organizations that work with immigrants, or?
When you need to coordinate your efforts with other organizations to bring refugees in,
we're working here in the U.S. What happens overseas is actually handled. It's you know, much of the work, the initial work, is done with the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, and then passed through the State Department. So that the refugees actually arrive under government sponsorship, and then they're handed off to private nonprofits to actually help them with the resettlement process. So it's, you know, I think what, on a larger level, that I'm not, don't have expertise in, but what's worrisome is that the administration has also taken a very adversarial attitude toward the UN. But that, you know, who knows where we'll end up with that.
I didn't realize if you were in that tier or when you know, when your involvement gets in. I understand that.
Yeah.
That was a lousy last question.
No, it's okay.
There's no wrong question. Yeah. Thank you so much, Harriet Kaur, Executive Director of the International Rescue Committee, known here as the IRC, in Charlottesville and Richmond. And I'm sure you could go to the website if people want to get involved with your organization.
Yeah, rescue.org.
There you go, rescue.org. Cool. Please go there if you're interested at all. Our next guest I'm so happy to have is Richard C. Schrager. He is the Per Bowen Professor of Law and the Joseph C. Carter Jr. Research Professor of Law at the UVA School of Law here in Charlottesville, Virginia. His scholarship focuses on the intersection of constitutional and local government law, federalism, urban policy, and the constitutional and economic status of cities. He has written the book City Power, Urban Governance in a Global Age from Oxford University Press, 2016. Richard, Professor Schrager, welcome to the
studio. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome.
Thanks for that.
Hi, Professor.
Thank you, and thanks for that great introduction.
Oh, you're welcome. Yeah,
you are definitely impressive. I will already confess, I hope I can sound like these questions were, in fact, written by me, but I certainly, I don't want to waste too. I know we're running.
I think we all have our skills and our assets, and I think, you know, you're doing amazing.
Sure. If you say so. My first question to you, sir, Professor, is actually about that the stay on that ruling. What do you make of it? You know, include everything, please.
Things are moving. So I would just say things are moving so quickly. I'm getting this information from the New York Times, just like lots of other people. And what they're reporting is that there's a nationwide stay on two parts of the order, both the visa holders part and the refugee part, which I wasn't sure about. Part of the refugee problem constitutionally is that not only have they suspended from Syria basically indefinitely and then elsewhere, there's also a part of the order that seems to favor Christians over non-Christians. And that is, in my estimation and my analysis of the original order, is a violation of the Establishment Clause and possibly the Free Exercise Clause of the U.S. Constitution. You cannot favor a particular religion over another religion by giving benefits to one over another. And the public statements of the administration prior to Trump's election and after it indicate what we call in legal terms animus towards Muslims. So the Muslim ban is a religious-specific ban, even though the order is not written to speak in terms of religion. The impact of the order has this religious impact. And so the state of Virginia, for example, recently filed a lawsuit against the Commonwealth, has filed a lawsuit contesting the order and has brought this particular claim in addition to due process claims and equal protection claims. This claim is also in the complaint, which says you can't favor Christian refugees over non-Christian refugees.
You know, I hope this is an aside. Tell me if this is not worth talking about, but I was just curious. I am aware that different states and different attorneys general are, you know, since last Friday night have sent, I don't even know what the correct word is, you know, saying it's unlawful, saying they want to take it to court. And like the one in Washington, I know, as I said, I know there's one in New York and one in Virginia. So is that, why doesn't one, because all of those seem to like distract from just like moving forward on kicking this thing to the curb. Doesn't all of these different suits, you know, work to Trump's benefit, that we have to settle them all? How does that, is that a side note? Is that a stupid question?
No, it's not stupid. It's litigation is complicated, and the way it often works is lawyers, we have basically a decentralized legal system. And if a lawyer, if someone comes to you as an attorney and as a client, say somebody with a visa or a green card holder and they can't go home because they'll be excluded or they're stuck in an airport, the lawyer can file a lawsuit. Any lawyer can do that. What has happened is people got stuck at airports. Lawyers went down to those airports, which is just amazing to see. And they got clients. And some of those clients then filed lawsuits immediately. And some of those were organizations like the ACLU or the refugee rights organizations, and they filed on behalf of these clients. Some are just individual clients represented by individual private attorneys. And then some of these states have sued on behalf of their interests. And in the Virginia suit, for example, Virginia is saying, we have been hurt ourselves. And by ourselves, we mean our universities, our colleges are injured by this because we have students and faculty who can't travel back and forth or can't get into the country. And so they have their own particular kind of injury that they're trying to get relief for. So you have all these lawsuits, and we also have a system in which you can file in lots of different places. There are district courts all over the country. There are state courts. Most of these are filed in federal courts because these are federal laws. And this is what happens. You file in Seattle or in Boston, and a district judge can issue a nationwide order. And then eventually through the litigation process, those things might get consolidated on appeal in various ways.
I just want to say that if you just tuned in, we're speaking with Professor Richard Schrager. He is a professor at law at UVA School of Law. And this is the first show of Apropos of Something on 94.7 WPVC Resistance Radio.
I have one more quick follow-up to that. Then in, like, for instance, that Washington ruling versus the one that is not yet resolved in Virginia, why does the Virginia one still need to be until Trump changes everything, but if the Washington one nullifies the whole thing, why does that Virginia one still matter, which is probably not the right word?
Yeah, so these are useful procedural questions, which what happens is the litigation, each litigation goes forward. What courts will do is take notice of what has happened. So if there's a nationwide stay, which seems to be the case from Seattle, then the other courts also impose stays. Some of the courts in Boston impose a stay. There's a Virginia court that imposed a stay. Those stays are of different timelines, and what they usually do is then ask the government to come back and make arguments as to why the stay should be lifted. These are all temporary because they haven't litigated the case. What they've done is they've said, we are likely to succeed, and there's going to be irreparable harm if you don't put the stay on. Those are the legal, that's the legal terminology for these things. And then they will issue the stay, but the stay will be temporary until you can actually litigate what they say is the merits of the case. And so what will happen now is the stay will stay in place. There'll be fights about whether the stay should stay in place. And then other courts will recognize that there's a stay and say, well, we'll just move to the merits, let's say, of the case. And again, some of these cases will have different components to them. Some will be on behalf of the Commonwealth and the universities in the Commonwealth. Some will be on behalf of green card holders. Some will be on behalf of visa holders. Some will be on behalf of refugees. And to be sure, it is quite messy, and it will be quite messy for a while.
Okay. All right. I would ask you more, but I already feel like people are tired of me asking this stuff. Well, I am curious about a completely adjacent subject. This idea of a sanctuary city, why aren't inherently all cities sanctuary cities?
Well, that's a fair question. Cities generally don't have constitutional status in the United States. They are considered, at least as a constitutional matter, instrumentalities or agencies of their states. That doesn't mean they don't have authority of various kinds, but that authority is granted by the particular state or commonwealth that they're in. In this case, we do have doctrines of federalism which say the following, that the federal government can't commandeer, and this is the language they use, commandeer local officials to do federal tasks. And by local, they mean state or local. They mean state or municipal officials. And so you can't order, the federal government can't order under the Supreme Court's precedent, can't order local officials to enforce immigration mm-hmm. laws.
Right.
The other part of this is they say you can't force a locality or a state, in this case we're talking about localities, you can't force a locality or a state to do something by withholding funds from them if you're withholding a lot of funds. If you're only withholding a few funds, it might be okay as long as Congress made that explicit. But you can't blanketly threaten a state or locality with the removal of all their funds, federal funds, if they don't cooperate with federal officials. So that gives cities a little bit of room to maneuver, but it doesn't give them total room to maneuver. So, for example, Austin, Texas, wants to be a sanctuary city, but the state of Texas has said you need to cooperate with federal officials because the state has different interests than the city of Austin. And the state is allowed to do that. There's nothing that bars the state from withholding their funds from a locality that might refuse to follow these federal immigration laws.
Again, we're talking with Professor Richard Schrager. He is the Per Bowen Professor of Law, the Joseph C. Carter Jr. Research Professor of Law at the UVA School of Law. And he's written a book which I wouldn't mind hearing just a little tiny bit about, because it looks so interesting, if you don't mind, Nancy. It's called called City Power, Urban Governance in a Global Age, from Oxford University Press.
Yeah, well, thanks. I'd love to talk about City Power.
I mean, you have 2 seconds.
Yeah, very quickly, what we're seeing, and I think the timing, I didn't really mean for this to happen, but the timing of the book is good in the following way, which is we now have a real conflict between progressive cities, lots of progressive cities, not all are progressive, but progressive cities like Charlottesville or New York or L.A. or Chicago, and the President of the United States and the federal government, which is hostile to what these cities want to do. And the question is, can the cities engage in a certain kind of resistance? And they have some room to maneuver. They have stated, lots of mayors have stated, that they will be opposing these kinds of federal laws and that they can do so under our principles of federalism. So the book is not directly about that, but it is about the relative power of cities. And it does advocate for more city power, both as against their states and as against the federal government. And it, in my estimation, cities are the place where we can work out many of the problems of inequality in this country. We can work out the problems of immigration. We can work out the problems of diversity and economic development. And they should have more authority to do the things that their constituents are seeking for them to do. And they are the engines of economic growth and development in the United States. And we have a serious urban-rural split that the last election showed. And that's one that we have to solve. But I think cities are where the action is going to be. And they should have the power that's commensurate with their importance.
Well, please come back and talk about that, because I know Trump is determined to do otherwise. So I would love to, you know, hear more specifics about, I'm sure, events that have come up. I know I have to wind this up. I'm sorry. Just promise you'll come back and talk about that.
Sure, I'd love to. Thanks for having me.
Okay. Yeah, thank you so much, Professor Schrager. I want to thank all our guests on the station, 94.7 WPVC, or on the show, rather, apropos of something. Our guests have been Rachel Adams, Harriet Kaur, Elizabeth Valtierra, and Professor Richard Schrager. Thank you so much. Well, Nancy.
Oh, my God, we have time left?
Oh,
are we chatting?
Like 30
are we
seconds.
On the air chatting?
Yeah, we're chatting.
All right, so how are all the knobs and the dials? How do you feel?
It's good. I might sign off any minute, and I just wanted to mention that Indivisible has an action on February 7th. Check it out on Facebook. Look for 94.7 WPVC on Facebook. And please tune in next Saturday and every Saturday at 10 o'clock here at Resistance Radio.